You are listening to the Stillbirth Matters podcast, presented by the Star Legacy Foundation, a national nonprofit founded on the belief that every pregnancy deserves a happy ending. Visit us online at starlegacyfoundation.org.
Welcome to another episode of the Stillbirth Matters podcast. My name is Lindsay Wimmer. I'm the executive director of the Star Legacy Foundation, and it is my pleasure and honor today to be talking to Dr. Mana Parast, who is a pathologist at the University of California in San Diego. She has actually been on our podcast before, and she's a great friend of Star Legacy Foundation and a wonderful resource as we continue to dig into how we can learn more about what causes pregnancy losses and how, obviously, to prevent them in the future. So thank you for joining us, Mana.
Thank you so much for having me, Lindsay.
So obviously the hot topic the last 2 years, now I can't believe it's been over 2 years, is COVID. And we have been learning a lot over that time. But right now we're seeing that the COVID impact on pregnancy tends to really have to do with how it impacts the placenta. Can you talk a little bit about what do we know about COVID and its impact on these placentas or what we don't know still?
Yeah, that is a very good question. And it's an ongoing exploration by, I want to say everybody that I know in this field, every perinatal pathologist that I know and have talked to over the past year and a half or so has been has gotten in one way or another involved in answering this question, just kind of by default. At our own institution, when the pandemic started, we immediately thought that, you know, that's going to be an open question, and in order to answer that in the sort of, you know, least biased way possible, the best thing to do would be to make COVID infection and pregnancy an indication for placental examination. And this way we can say that at our institution, we have looked at all such placentas, and we can say what the rate of placental injury is, and how are these patterns of placental injury different from other types of infection in pregnancy, et cetera. Our study is still ongoing. We have now looked at, unfortunately, over, 650 cases of COVID infection in pregnancy. I wanna say that at least our findings up to date are consistent with what's been published. So I can talk a little bit about that. So very early on in the pandemic, there were studies that were coming out, Dr. Bergens in particular, looking at, being in New York City at the center of the pandemic early on, they looked at some placentas and saw that there was an increased rate of lesions of fetal vascular malperfusion. This is lesions that indicate that there is maybe some abnormal fetal blood flow in the placenta. Later on, studies came out that said there are also increased rates of lesions of maternal vascular malperfusion. These are lesions that result from compromise of maternal circulation to the placenta and can cause infarction and damage, in that sense to the placenta. Kind of more and more papers that were published also brought attention to some inflammatory lesions in the placenta. So there is increased rates of inflammatory cells infiltrating, maternal inflammatory cells that were infiltrating the placenta and causing damage and tissue death. And so now, like you said, can't believe it, but yeah, almost 2 years out, looking at all of these different studies, the consensus seems to be that the inflammatory lesions are kind of, you know, the common denominator in all of these different placentas. It seems to be that different studies maybe see a different extent of this inflammation and the associated damage that the inflammation causes. But it seems like the consensus now is that COVID-induced inflammation in the placenta causes placental damage and probably compromises its function. Now, I want to say one of the biggest limitations right now is that these changes to the placenta have yet to be sort of directly linked to the adverse outcomes that we see in terms of the increased rates of preterm birth, increased rates of stillbirth. So, you know, in that sense, I feel like we still have a good way to go. You know, these are not easy studies to do. They require collaborations between institutions and groups, and they require large numbers of samples to be looked at, both in terms of the course of the infection in pregnancy. You know, was mom symptomatic? You know, there are some studies that looked at viral load during pregnancy, but having all of that information and correlating that to, you know, the changes in the placenta and then subsequent outcome of the pregnancy, that kind of all needs to be put together. And so I feel like we still have, you know, some ways to go.
Yeah, I think that's a really important distinction, because just because we see some physiologic changes, whether or not that is significant enough to lead to the poor outcomes is a really important point. I think it's just a very natural thing to want to be able to have an answer or an explanation, and it's easy to find those things and make that leap when it may not be appropriate.
Yeah, exactly. There is, I know that some groups have started also to look at, you know, do they, not only do they see the virus in the placenta, but is the virus actively replicating in the placenta? We have group here that has looked at that, has actually in collaboration with people in the Department of Pediatrics. Dr. Francesca Sonson in our group is looking at the impact of the virus on placental cells, how they can in fact directly, the virus can infect placental cells directly and replicate. But again, to the extent that, you know, it's very difficult to detect this, especially if, say, you know, mom has been infected, you know, early or mid-pregnancy and doesn't deliver until weeks or months later. You know, the question of, you know, when you are looking at the placental tissue just at the time of delivery and looking to see, well, did the, you know, did, is virus there, or did it replicate at some point? And so it's hard to answer those questions with just, you know, having access to the placenta at delivery. Thankfully, as I'm sure you know, and your audience knows too, vertical transmission has been recorded to be extremely, extremely rare. It can happen, but it is rare. But again, to the extent that, you know, this virus we know can infect placental cells, but, you know, how does it, when does it, you know, cause inflammation? How does it cause damage? And, you know, are there ways, for example, to be able to prevent that even once virus has infected the placenta? You know, are there, you know, things that we can do to interfere, to prevent that damage and potentially prevent an adverse pregnancy outcome? Those are still unanswered questions.
Yeah, that's fascinating. And I think it also highlights the importance of doing really, really good evaluations anytime we have a poor outcome, because we know that that's not something that is a very easy thing for a lot of parents to consent to, or they may not really even understand exactly what is being asked of them at the time that they're approached about autopsy, but of course, lots of other types of testing as well. Can you talk a little bit about, obviously in these big things like the pandemic, those tests can help us learn more about a specific condition like this, but just in other, maybe not COVID specific scenarios, what role does pathology play both in terms of helping find answers for that family, but also towards our search for prevention opportunities?
Yeah, that is a very good question. And some of these questions have been raised recently in context of, you know, overall placental examination. You know, how useful is it in terms of understanding causes of stillbirth, causes of other adverse pregnancy complications? I don't think the question of how useful placental pathology is in stillbirth, I think, is in identifying a cause, or at least things that contributed to stillbirth. I don't think that's really questioned by many people. I think the majority of obstetricians and other clinical staff understand the importance of evaluating the placenta in the setting of pregnancy loss, particularly in the latter half of pregnancy. The question more recently has been kind of in a more as a more widespread test for identifying other causes or other other causes of adverse pregnancy outcomes, such as fetal growth restriction, a baby, for example, that ends up in the neonatal intensive care unit. You know, what can the placenta tell us in those situations? And I think that is, you know, from a pathology perspective, it's appreciated, but maybe not as much from a clinical care perspective. And so I think it's important for us as pathologists to communicate our findings better to clinicians, also to patients, with regard to how important this is. So I can give several examples. I know that in starting with stillbirth, as you know, and I'm sure your audience knows, a lot of cases of stillbirth are associated with fetal growth restriction. And the placenta in these cases, a lot of times, is small and has lesions that can explain point to contributions to placental insufficiency, or you know issues with the placenta that contributed to the baby's lack of oxygen or nutrients, and so in that sort of same context, even in the absence of stillbirth, when you do have fetal growth restriction, it is very important to look at the placenta. There are many different patterns of placental injury that can explain the cause of fetal growth restriction. And depending on also the severity of those patterns of injury, you can predict what the likelihood is of this same lesion happening in subsequent pregnancies. And that is a very important piece of information for the patient and for their clinical care team in subsequent pregnancies. There are lesions in the placenta that can, for example, point to an underlying maternal autoimmune disease that could have contributed to fetal growth restriction. In those cases, the chance of recurrence can be as high as 50%. There are other lesions, for example, lesions that have to do with abnormal fetal circulation in the placenta. Those could be incidental. And if those contributed to fetal growth restriction, you know, the likelihood of recurrence is, you know, tends to be really low. So knowing, you know, whether your chance of recurrence of fetal growth restriction is, you know, 5% versus 50% in a subsequent pregnancy can be very important. There are also, you know, if, you know, lesions in the placenta are discovered that can, that point to maternal autoimmune disease, such as antiphospholipid antibody syndrome or other types of autoimmune disease, there may be steps that can be taken to prevent fetal growth restriction and subsequent pregnancies. Definitely, I've heard that aspirin and other types of low molecular weight heparin or other administration of other drugs can help prevent fetal growth restriction in these settings. But of course, you know, this all requires consultation with the obstetrician, discussion of risk, but it all, again, begins with a thorough examination of the placenta, identification of the placental injury pattern that then would lead to subsequent testing of mom, establishment of a specific diagnosis, and then the discussion of risk and you know, how risk reduction can take place in the subsequent pregnancy.
Yeah, I think that's a really important point, because it's all becomes a part of a bigger picture, and it's putting all the puzzle pieces together.
Yeah.
With another topic that I know you and I have talked about before, but another example would be umbilical cord accidents. Can you kind of talk about the value when umbilical cord is suspected to be implicated in the outcome?
Yeah, that's a very good question. And it's, I think it becomes important to look at the placenta, because a lot of times without placental examination and without any other sort of apparent cause of stillbirth, sometimes the umbilical cord, you know, kind of becomes the default victim, if you will, being blamed for the cause of death. And, you know, the idea of umbilical cord accidents, you know, umbilical cord can be abnormal in a lot of otherwise healthy pregnancies. The cord can be wrapped around the neck in a pregnancy, but otherwise the baby's born healthy and fine. So the question of whether an umbilical cord actually caused some sort of harm, you know, really cannot be determined without a good, thorough placental examination. So on placental examination, other than, you know, of course, you start out with sort of grossly examining the placenta, again, just an external exam, determining the length of the umbilical cord, you know, whether the umbilical cord was abnormally attached to the placenta instead of being attached at the center where it should be attached, if it's attached at the margin or at the, you know, into the membranes. All of these are part of the external examination of the placenta that can point to an abnormality that could have predisposed the umbilical cord to constriction, to obstruction, to tearing, et cetera. And, but more importantly, then looking at samples of the placenta, the placental disc actually under the microscope, there are, again, lesions of fetal vascular malperfusion, lesions that tell the pathologist that there has been abnormal fetal blood flow in the placenta. And these lesions include small clots in fetal circulation. And these are lesions that can be the cause of abnormal fetal blood flow because of some sort of obstruction or constriction or lesion of the umbilical cord. And so when you suspect, particularly in the setting of stillbirth, when you suspect that the umbilical cord is, you know, may have been the cause. Of course, an autopsy is helpful, even a limited limited autopsy where the baby can be examined externally and some measurements taken to determine, you know, is the baby growth restricted? If the baby's growth restricted, is it a symmetric or asymmetric growth restriction? That is also very helpful. So symmetric growth restriction usually points to either some sort of underlying chromosomal abnormality or some sort of event early on in pregnancy that caused the baby to be small all around versus an asymmetric growth restriction, which is also referred to as head sparing growth restriction, where the head is proportionally more normal compared to the body. The body is more growth restricted. This asymmetric pattern of growth restriction usually points to the placenta as being an underlying etiology of stillbirth. And again, this is where the examination of the placenta can be very helpful. And in the setting of umbilical cord being suspected as the cause of stillbirth, ruling out other potential contributors to stillbirth is useful. And then examination of the placenta, both externally and under the microscope, can identify those lesions that point to this abnormal fetal blood flow in the placenta as the cause of stillbirth.
It's just so fascinating. And I think it it highlights how there's so much more than we tend to think of from the gross anatomy element of pathology and what we can learn from that. So that's amazing. Yeah. I've had the pleasure of being able to tour your lab and meet several members of your team. Would you like to give us a little bit of an update of some of the things that you are working on and some things we can kind of expect or watch for?
Yeah, absolutely. So thank you for asking about that. Usually, you know, research is, you know, takes so long and, you know, requires so much effort to sort of guide a project from, you know, when it's just an idea to actually obtaining funding, you know, executing to, you know, publication that sometimes, it takes a lot. Long time, but also requires a lot of effort by multiple people. It's really nice specifically to discuss these results and or progress with you and in general with people that are interested in this field. And so we've had, as I mentioned, we do have an ongoing study of COVID infection in pregnancy that we hope to be wrapping up in the next few months. One of our maternal fetal medicine fellows here has been working hard on this, looking at not just the placentas from patients infected with COVID in pregnancy, but looking at kind of a control group. And, you know, selection of the control group can be difficult. The question is, do you look at, you know, patients whose placentas were reviewed before the pandemic or those that, you know, whose placentas were looked at during the pandemic, but for non-COVID reasons. So, you know, the study got really big because we basically decided to be completely safe and include both control groups. So Dr. Lauren Gabby, who is our maternal fetal medicine fellow, is wrapping up this project, hopefully in the next few months. And we also hope to look more closely at some of these changes in the placenta that I was describing that has been shown to occur specifically with COVID, inflammatory lesions and how they damage the placenta. So we want to look more closely at those and see whether there are specific mechanisms that we can identify, specific inflammatory pathways, inflammatory cells that get recruited to the placenta. You know, what those are and how they might be causing damage to the placenta. On the sort of non-COVID front, we're also, we just recruited a new director for our division of neonatology here at UCSD. And as you know, we also recently established our Center for Perinatal Discovery, which myself and Dr. Louise Laurent are co-directors of. And with the recruitment of Dr. Karen Meston as our new division chief of neonatology, we now have our third co-director of our Center for Perinatal Discovery. So the three of us have really, sort of banded together in order to figure out how we can best push forward research, not just into pregnancy health, but also subsequent neonatal and pediatric health. So what the center is launching right now are studies that, where we follow not just patients during pregnancy, collecting samples and data, including placenta at delivery, but also then following up the babies to evaluate outcomes in the early neonatal period, but also into the first 5 years of life. So looking at outcomes, for example, including metabolic health, development of childhood obesity is thought to be very much linked to events that happen during pregnancy, including, for example, diabetes in pregnancy and other complications. So kind of looking at how pregnancy could potentially program obesity in the pediatric population is a large interest of our center that we hope to push forward in the next few years. We're kind of starting ahead of kind of that big picture. We are collaborating with folks in neonatology to look at immediate neonatal outcomes of some of the pregnancies that we've been following. So we have a neonatology fellow who is working closely with us to look at patterns of placental injury and how these particular patterns of placental injury subsequently result in complications in the neonatal period, particularly in the population that ends up in the neonatal intensive care unit. So we're very interested in making sure that the research that we do, even though a lot of it involves looking at tissues or cells under the microscope, measuring the cell and tissue function, we want to make sure that these studies that we do have impact on helping us understand how pregnancy complications happen, but also in turn, how pregnancy complications then impact neonatal and pediatric health.
Well, that is just fascinating. And I am so inspired and excited every time I hear you talk about your work. And I am very grateful, as I'm sure many of our listeners are too, that there's people as brilliant as yourself working towards all these outcomes to make things so much better for all of us. So thank you so much for all of your hard work.
Thanks, Lindsay. And I also just want to say that none of this would be possible without the participation of patients. And we've been so grateful here to have so many people so easily volunteer to have blood drawn, donate their placentas to research. And it's just so helpful. And words cannot express our thanks. There are so many people here that, would not be able to do this research without, all the willing and very enthusiastic patients.
Yeah, it truly does take a lot of partnerships.
Yep, exactly. Yeah.
Well, I just wanted to give one quick shout out. You mentioned your Center for Perinatal Discovery. You will be having your next annual symposium on June 25th, I believe.
Yes.
If I have that date correct. So anybody who is interested in these this type of work, they do a really phenomenal job with this meeting, and I would encourage you to check it out and definitely participate, because I promise you will learn so many amazing things during that meeting. And then just one other plug too is that we are very, very excited that we're going to be partnering with the Center for Perinatal Discovery, and they are going to help us host the next Stillbirth Summit in June of 2023 on the UCSD campus. So we are definitely looking forward to that as well.
Can't wait. Can't wait to host you guys. We're very overdue for that.
Yes. Yes. For those who don't know, this was supposed to happen in 2020 or 21, excuse me. And for obvious reasons, that did not happen. So we're hopeful and very excited to get that back on track. So thank you so much for your time and for sharing your expertise and really making it relatable and understandable, because sometimes this can be very hard for people who aren't medical, but certainly even some people who are medical, it can be a very foreign world to try to understand some of this, and you make it very relatable. So thank you so much for taking the time and for being such a great partner with Star Legacy.
Of course. Thanks again. Thanks for having me.
Of course. Take care.
That's all for this episode of the Stillbirth Matters podcast, presented by the Star Legacy Foundation. Contact us at info@starlegacyfoundation.org to share feedback, request support, or suggest topics or guests for future podcast episodes.